The energy of power, the moving force of aspiration, the impulse of desire are all his, and already his soul is marching on in the ranks of those lofty ones whose mission is to toil on until man becomes uplifted into the sphere of universal love, until all wrong shall flee, tyranny die, and liberty and knowledge dwell in the homes of all people. Press on, noble soul. The victor's palm is thine, for thou hast witnessed the triumph of justice and right. The crown of glory is thine, for thy soul is crowned with the diadem of perfect love. Press on, white-robed soul, for the bright fruition that awaits thee. The following chapters are devoted to a recital of the experiences of J.C. Prince, as narrated by himself, and published in The Voice of Angels. We have alluded to letters of approval and of interest concerning these experiences received by the editor of that paper from various quarters. The following extract from a published letter of one of these correspondents is here given, for the reason that it was penned by one intimately acquainted with Mr. Prince in earthly life, and familiar with the general style of his compositions. A. Niffy, Utah, September 6, 1878. To the editor of The Voice of Angels. Dear brother, A. I have felt like writing to you since you began to publish The Spirit Experiences of John Critchley Prince, for I have been deeply interested in reading his statements as they appear in your paper. I am from the same part of England where Mr. Prince dwelt when in the body, and was in 1850 a power loom weaver in the West Mills at Ashton-under-Lyne, where he then resided. I always admired his poems, and, next to Byron, esteemed his poetry the grandest and best I had then read. I recognize the mind of John Critchley Prince, the Lancashire poet, in every line of his account of his earth life in your paper. My wife also recognizes it, she having attended select parties where he recited some of his best poems, in Duck Enfield and Ashton-under-Lyne, and we read in surprise and astonishment his first contribution to The Voice, not expecting anything of the kind. It was to us most interesting and agreeable. We congratulate you upon the acquisition of so noble a soul to your staff of contributors, and hope he will often give us his rich effusions through your paper. Your brother and well-wisher, Thomas J. Schofield. Chapter 21. My Life and Experiences on Earth. My friends, A. Bearing the fraternal greetings of not only myself but hosts of higher spirits, whose pleasure and duty it is to mingle with you here, and who strive to teach you wisdom and knowledge concerning the highest, grandest phase of human existence, that of the immortal soul, I come laden with the experiences of a modicum of time passed in the supermundane spheres, and crave an opportunity of unfolding them before you, A. Not with a desire for earthly recognition or adulation, A. But with the hope that I may be enabled to show humanity the reality of those conditions that we aggregate to ourselves while immortal, and their practical effects on the soul, trusting that I may enlighten you somewhat as to real life, and its mode of manifestation in the upper spheres, for it is time that mortals should understand more of the life to which they are going. It is now 9, a period of 70 years since I, John Critchley Prince, was born upon the earthly plane, at Wigan, Lancashire, England, of poor, hard-working, honest parents. My only schooling was given me at a Baptist Sunday school, where I received a slight knowledge of reading and writing. But as I read with avidity all sorts of books that happened to fall in my way, I acquired a certain command of language, and knowledge of composition, that served in after years as a noble substitute for the education I was unable to procure, and which I always craved. At the early age of 9 years I was obliged to labor for my living as a reed maker for weavers, at which I was kept busy for 16 hours per day, and my only opportunity for indulging in the luxury of reading was stolen from sleep. Footnote 9, the above was written in the spring of 1878. In 1821 I accompanied my father to Manchester, where we both obtained employment as machinists. There, for the first time, I came across a copy of Byron's works, which I devoured with astonishing rapidity, drinking in and retaining all the glory, fire, and beauty of those exquisite lines, and their delicate imagery, that made Byron, despite his faults, one of nature's poets. What a world of delight, what a scene of enchantment was for the first time opened before me. I seemed to breathe a new atmosphere, one that thrilled my being to its very center, and while reveling in the new fields of splendor I had found, I forgot my poverty and toil. My soul stood forth erect in its conscious dignity and pride, feeling itself to be no longer a poor, toiling slave, but a creature of the universe, with powers and capabilities of expansion and growth. It was then I determined that someday I would sing my songs, and give them forth to the world. But my life went on in the old routine, still toiling in the shop, and dreaming my dreams all unknown to others, until my father again changed his abode to hide, taking me with him. There, in the early flush of awakening manhood, ere 19 summers had passed over my head, came to my waiting soul that most exquisite of all life's experiences, love's young dream. It came upon me like the first sweet dewy blush of early morn, bathing my spirit in a flood tide of ineffable glory, and thrilling my heart with that ecstatic bliss that I think none but a poetic soul, attuned in harmony with nature and her works, and thus enabled to find happiness in spite of toil or sorrow, can fully realize. And here let me say that to this day, returning as I do from the immortal shore, I thank God for that experience of true, heartfelt emotion. It accompanied me through all my life like the melody of a happy song, and thrilled my despairing soul with its sweetness. It ran through my evil days of wrongdoing like a golden thread, and with its sparkling light revealed to me the glory and honor, the sweetness and purity, of life that might have been mine. It is useless for me to attempt to depict the image of my charmer to you. To others, she was only a neighbor's lassie, good enough and pretty in her way, but nothing uncommon. To me she was all that was fair and canny, and as beautiful and good as Eve appeared to her Adam, in all her innocent purity of expression on that first awakening which we are told of in the beautiful allegory of old. In 1827 I was united to my dear one, and we commenced life anew, as happy as two birds, and, though from my poetic fancy and ardent temperament, I was led to look for more happiness in a life of conjugal felicity than it is possible for mortals to attain, yet, upon the whole, my domestic life was a blessing to my inner self, and in its bowers I wove some of the sweetest garlands that graced my name. Poverty and toil, with their train of evils, still attended me, and in 1830, work being slack at home, I went to Picardy, leaving my family of wife and three children. The revolution had paralyzed trade in France, and it was impossible to procure employment there. Consequently, after experiencing much suffering, I returned home only to find my family in a workhouse, from whence I removed them to a Manchester garret, where we would have starved had it not been for the labors of my wife at power loom weaving. That was a time of misery. Attained temporary employment, and our prospects began to brighten a little, but through all my life a scarcity of remunerative work seemed to attend me like a fatality. During my residence at Manchester I began to contribute short poetic pieces to the local papers and periodicals, which, by the kindness of friends, and those powerful in government affairs, whose attention was first called to me by the perusal of my literary productions, were issued in volumes from time to time. The first of these, Hours with the Muses, was brought out in 1840, and reached its third edition in 2 years. The subsequent volumes were, Dreams and Realities in Verse, 1847, The Poetic Rosary, 1856, Miscellaneous Poems, 1861, and one more containing all my principal poems, published the year of my death, 1866. I have been accused of imitating the style of others, but while I may have done so to some extent, I think none of my critics will deny that the ideas expressed, and the thoughts embodied, together with the arrangement of language in my productions, were entirely my own. At the same time I was never satisfied with my efforts, none of them reached my standard of excellence, and they sometimes bore marks of my disappointment and dissatisfaction. From the disappointments I had encountered in early manhood, I was all too easily induced to hie away from my squalid attic home to the public house, where, in the company of men who pretended to admire my AA genius, and to court my society, I would spend hours, aye, days, away from home, indulging in sin, thereby seeking to drown the memory of disappointed ambition and blighted hopes. And to this habit, together with a certain unsteadiness of purpose that kept me from holding on to any employment for any length of time, I am indebted for many of my early experiences in spirit life, some account of which I hope to unfold before you, that you may learn how a soul is plunged in darkness from the effects of deeds done in the body, and also how it may progress through degradation and woe to scenes of happiness and peace, if it only desires to do so. I have been thus prolix concerning my mortal life that you may better understand my experiences in the spirit, and though I may have seemed too personal, it was unavoidable, and I crave your kind indulgence. It is impossible for me to convey to you any adequate conception of the ecstatic bliss I experienced in spirit when lifted above material bonds, and basking in the realm of poetic fancy, of the toil and sorrow of my physical existence, or of my feeling of utter degradation and self-contempt when recovering from a debauch, all of which I was compelled to outlive in spirit. Chapter 22. My Life and Experiences in the Spirit World. May 5, 1866, I parted with my tenement of clay, and was born into the world, not only of primal causes, but also that in which all effects of past living are made manifest. Mind and body were alike a wreck. I had no great satisfaction for the past, and but little hope for the future. While passing out from the material I was dimly conscious of a crowd of beings pressing around me, faces I had known long before, but which I had not seen for years, forms once familiar, but which the passing scenes of life had blotted from memory, men whom I had met in times past around the social board, and amid scenes of convivial allurement, where we had wasted the precious, God-given moments in song or story, unfruitful of any profitable result, those of whose destiny I was ignorant, and whom I supposed had forgotten me as I had ceased to remember them, all were here, recalling by their presence scenes and memories that I could wish to be dead and buried beyond possibility of resurrection. All the events of my life passed before my inner vision like a panorama, and I saw myself as others saw me, as a victim of wasted energies and an ill-spent life. How keenly did I regret much that I had done, and much more that I might have done, but did not. It was then and there, while seemingly unconscious to mortal things, I began to fully realize that omission is oftentimes as great a sin as commission, that inactivity is as disastrous to the spirit as misplaced volition. At this time, I did not see the forms and faces of any of those I had loved, and whom it might be supposed would be first at the deathbed of one so near to them. These forms and phantoms that surrounded me were encompassed by a cloud of heavy vapor, that entirely veiled the horizon from my sight. I strove to turn from them, but could not, they hedged me in on every side, and, while they spake no word, they seemed to mock me with their taunting looks and gestures. This was my first spirit experience. I have since learned that it consisted entirely of the reflection of past recollections upon my mind, but it was extremely annoying and unpleasant. My next experience was standing by myself, outside of my physical body, alone, so far as I could see, gazing down upon the old, worn-out tenement that I had recently vacated. I found myself clothed in a body precisely similar to the one I had left, and not in much better condition, apparently. I was perplexed and bewildered, for, though spurning many of the old theologic notions of the hereafter, this was certainly not the fulfillment of my conceptions of a future life. I gazed around, hoping to attract the attention of someone who could give me an explanation, or in the expectation of meeting my boon companions, but all in vain. I could see no one. All was misty, or rather in a smoky fog, like the streets of London at midday, though I have since been informed that I was not alone, that there were loving, helping spirits watching over me, to assist me when possible, but my mental condition prevented me from perceiving them, and that the smoky vapor was an emanation from my own spirit, and did not proceed from the state of the atmosphere. While ruminating to myself, as collectively as my condition would allow, I observed a party of individuals approach and take a view of my remains, and what appeared very curious to me, while they seemed very far away from me, I could distinctly hear their remarks. These parties were mortals, still dwelling on earth, drawn by a morbid kind of interest to take a final view of my body. However, I would they had stayed away, for they did my spirit more harm than good. "Eh, poor devil," said one, "he's gone at last. Well, he made a wreck of himself, sure enough." "Eh, aye," replied another, "he might have done better, but he would not, and so he's gone. I always knew how it would turn out." "Eh, oh, with all his singing and dreaming," remarked a third, "he was no better than the rest of us. The old one would show himself pretty often." "Eh, oh, that's so," chimed in the fourth, "wilt thee look at him now, lying there, when he might have been alive and well, like the rest of us. Well, he's gone to his account now, poor lad." I waited to hear no more. Mind and brain were alike maddened by what I had heard. It was all true enough, but every word seemed like a scorpion's sting, to pierce my soul. Who were these, that they should condemn one who had not the power to defend himself? Were they free from the common taint of sin? Thus I questioned, but unable to solve the mighty problems that seemed pressing down upon me, I made one Herculean effort, and, bursting the bonds that confined me to my useless body, I rushed from the place, away I knew not where, I cared not, only to get relief for my burning, tortured soul. And here allow, if you please, one digression. Let me warn you, oh, mortals, to mind how you speak and think of those who have departed the mortal life. Let your thoughts and words be as charitable and kind as possible, for by so doing you may furnish a beacon light that will brighten their paths upward. But if you speak ill of them, if you hurl the stone of censure at departing spirits, you may furnish the heavy weight that will drag them downward. Alas, I did not understand the cure of sin-sick, tortured souls, and I sought that refuge that had been, and was now again, my curse, but which I vainly thought would drown all recollection and bring relief. I soon found myself in a well-known spot, one of my former haunts of the back parlour, just beyond the taproom of a public house. I seated myself as naturally as ever, and waited for someone to comply with my demand for liquor, but while the barmaid flitted about, here and there, and several times brushed against my person in passing, she paid no attention to me whatever, and I felt myself neglected indeed. Presently, I observed, entering the apartment, one whom I had occasionally seen at that resort, and who I understood to be a hard drinker. He called for liquor, and when it was brought, raised the glass to his lips. Suddenly, by a sort of fascination, I was drawn to his side, and while he poured the fiery liquid down his throat, my whole being seemed to vibrate in sympathy, and became saturated with the fumes of the liquor. At every drop he tasted, I seemed to quaff a corresponding one, and I found I could indulge myself in that way to any extent. I remained by his side, drinking long and deep. Our potations lasted for hours. Oh, the craving desire I had for that deadly fluid, my deep delight and utter abandonment of self you cannot realize. At last our potations ceased. Abused and outraged nature could bear no more, and my companion sunk down in a complete state of insensibility. Then I strove to tear myself from him, but all in vain. I was held to his prostrate form by a cord as unyielding as bands of steel. I could not free myself from the conditions I had brought upon me. And here my retribution began, for, while the liquid we had drank together had drugged his senses, and benumbed his faculties, it had affected me in an entirely different way, serving to arouse all my sensibilities, fire my nervous system with flames of unquenchable desire, and, in fact, to make me keenly alive to all my surroundings. The least noise fell upon my hearing like the dismal knell of a lost soul, the sound of a passing foot startled me like a peal of thunder, and when the timepiece of the old clockhouse told the hour, my whole being vibrated in unison. I wanted to get away from everybody and everything I had known, A. To be alone by myself where no one could find me, where life and activity were unknown, and where I could rest my burning brain. Alas, I could not. Like one tied to a stake, I was condemned to pass what seemed to me a century of time by the side of one with whom I had nothing in common, save the craving of a perverted appetite. I cannot convey to you an idea of the horror, darkness, and despair that rent my soul while thus bound to that form of besotted humanity. The hours dragged, until at last there came a gleam of relief. Boniface entered the apartment, aroused my sleeping companion, and sent him to the pump room to bathe his head. At the first plash of the water a thrill of exquisite delight passed over me, a second and a third, and the band that had held me snapped in twain, and I was free. Never did weary captive rejoice at his deliverance more than did I at that moment. I made no stay, but hastened from the place, and have never seen it nor its inmates since. Still drifting along, my only aim and purpose being to gain some lonely, retired spot, where I might find rest and refreshment, I soon found myself rising gradually from the ground, and floating or sailing along, above the heads of the people. Before long, the city streets vanished from my sight, and I seemed to be approaching a strange part of the country. Houses and warehouses disappeared, sunny glades and shady nooks came into view, forest trees, clothed with garments of living green, beneath which tiny flowerets nodded their spicy heads, and scented the balmy air with their rich perfume. Away to the left I perceived the azure gleam of dimpling, sparkling waters. In the distance, towered the lofty peaks of purple-crested mountains, the sun shone brightly in the heavens, while the atmosphere became melodious with the hum of insects and the chirping of birds. No sound nor sight of human life could I perceive, all was silent, save the murmurings of nature, which fell upon my tortured being like an anthem of peace. "Ayo, surely," said I to myself, "this must be another country. It is entirely different from any I have ever seen before. The atmosphere wears that peculiar, transparent haze seen only in the lands of a southern clime." But I was too weary for further cognitions. I seemed to drink in the charm and beauty of the scene without any volition of will or thought, and to find comfort and rest in so doing. At last, I descried a perfect gem of a spot, one that appeared formed for a fairy bower, just beyond a leaping, laughing streamlet of limpid water, nestling quietly at the foot of a moss-covered, arch-shaped rocky wall. I beheld a tiny cove, so beautiful that it seemed almost sacrilege to intrude therein. Emerald banks, as beautiful as silk-pile velvet, starred with a profusion of creamy golden-eyed blossoms, trailing vines like maidenhair ferns creeping over the rocks, shrubs of vivid green, with scarlet bells, swinging their perfumed censers upon the breeze, sparkling sunbeams and cooling shadows, constituted a place of repose that a monarch might enjoy. And there, amid the beauties of nature's works, surrounded by the splendors of creation, pointing to the wondrous power and beneficence of God, I sank down upon the emerald sod, and, lulled by the peace and quiet of the place, my fevered senses grew calm, my pulses even, the blood cooled in my veins, and I fell into as complete a slumber as it is possible for a disembodied spirit to experience. I was unconscious of the lapse of time, yet I now know it was several days before I again awoke to a knowledge of my external surroundings. I was still alone, no human presence could I discern, the flowers still bloomed, the waters danced and gleamed, the sun shone, and all was as beautiful and as real as before. It appeared to me I had reposed there but a few short hours. I aroused myself, and, stepping down to the banks of the stream, proceeded to lave my face and hands, precisely as I would have done were I in the body. The water refreshed me. I seemed renewed with life and vigor, but with the new strength there also came a remembrance of what I had been, and what I had done, and I sank down upon the mossy bed overwhelmed with the recollection of my folly and madness. Remorse had again entered my presence, and my soul cowered down before it in bitter agony. Tears and sobs mingled together and shook my frame to its very center, and I wrestled in spirit with the might-have-been, which was as tangible to me as any objective form would be to mortals. As the tempest within my spirit grew less, I began to feel a holy presence approaching. Presently a low, soft strain of exquisitely modulated music fell upon my hearing, so faint, yet so sweet, did it at first appear that it seemed to blend with and form a part of the music of the murmuring waters and rustling leaves. Gradually it swelled louder, clearer, and sweeter, until it culminated in a burst of triumphant ecstasy, that made the very grasses leap in unison. My whole being was stilled, a deep peace pervaded my system. I was a man again, a creature of God, and one worthy to become a representative of His kingdom. As these thoughts permeated my being, causing it to grow calm and restful, I felt what seemed to be a breath of cool, invigorating air upon my temples, thrilling my whole frame with an indescribable sensation of delight, and, on looking up, I was amazed, but not startled, to observe the form of a venerable patriarch bending over me, and manipulating my brow with the tips of his fingers. His face was smooth and fair, as though no carking care had ever left its impress thereon, surmounted by a lofty brow, gleaming with the might of intellect, and crowned with a wealth of snowy, silken hair. A long, massy beard, lustrous with whiteness, fell upon his breast. He was clad in a long, purple robe of silken stuff, sandals of glistening brightness were upon his feet, while in his hand he carried a staff that was remarkable for its brilliancy. His features were luminous with the light of reflected love and benevolence, a halo of radiance encircled his whole being, which scintillated with sparks of light as he moved. Subsequently I learned that this halo was the aura flowing forth from his spiritual structure, the brilliancy of which revealed the purity and beauty of his interior condition. Abashed and humbled before the majestic glory of this presence, I hid my face from sight, and cowered down as if for concealment. "Ao, fear not, my son, I have come to help and encourage thee. Thy mortal ways were rough and devious, thy spiritual paths shall yet be ways of peace. Lift up thine head, that thy soul may be anointed with the balm of healing. Art dot of Mario Duguay not in original book, same as that below." I had heard no sound of voice, and yet these were the thoughts that flowed into the interior sensorium of my mind, as the mystic being continued to soothe my brow with his fingertips. I raised my head in questioning amaze, and gazed upon him in wonder. "Ao, thee questions who and what I am," again came the thoughts, not spoken, but impressed upon my mind. "I am one appointed to seek out and instruct souls like thine, who are in need of assistance. Thee mayst call me Abanger, the missionary. I am drawn to thee, to point out the way of salvation, and to give thee strength and encouragement. Thou hast fought the first battle and won the victory. Press on, and thou shalt win the goal." The thoughts, and indeed the presence of the missionary, sent a thrill of pleasure through my whole being. Help spread her rosy pinions above me, and I became strong, as I thought, for any conflict. "Ao, thou hast won thy first victory," repeated the sage, "but still other trials await thee, self-abnegation and the renunciation of those appetites and passions that have in a measure swayed the spirit come not all at once. Reformation is a work of time. Therefore, my son, trust not too much to thine own strength, but rather let thy soul's aspirations reach outward and upward toward heavenly things, bearing with them a desire for assistance and guidance. Neither be cast down, for eventually, a noble existence will be thine. Look around thee upon these laughing meadows and leaping waters. Thou wouldst know in what locality thou art. Ao, this is the valley of self-examination. Every soul in passing out from material life is born to some spot connected with this place. Certain temperaments are taken to yonder mountains, upon the lofty heights of which their souls are left to take a retrospective glance back upon their past lives, their actions, and motives, and to commune silently with themselves concerning life and its duties, others to that sheet of clear water you observe in the distance, into which they are forced to plunge, that they may be cleansed of the impurities that cling to their spirits. Ao, poetic souls like thine are conveyed to this charming valley, where, In the contemplation of nature's works, they find peace and strength to go on with the task of self-examination, and the attaining of a desire to become worthy of better things. The ideas flowing into my mind from the sage ceased, and in a moment more I was again alone. Suddenly the desire seized me to plunge into the stream babbling at my feet.